Tonight, we've got a rather different programme for you.
In 1954, David Attenborough embarked on a groundbreaking television series. Watched by millions of viewers across Britain, it became the most popular wildlife programme of its time. And it launched David Attenborough as a wildlife presenter.
If you don't want this bumble, I'm warning you, I'm giving it to Robert.
ZooQuest filmed a number of animal collecting expeditions organised by the London Zoo and brought to the screen places and animals that had never been seen before.
It was the first natural history series on film that the BBC had shot.
ZooQuest was first broadcast in the 1950s, over a decade before colour television came to the UK. So the entire series was shown in black and white. A few months ago, a remarkable discovery was made in the vaults of the BBC Natural History Unit. An archivist was checking through some of the film cans from ZooQuest. She took a closer look at these reels of film and realised that she had unearthed a piece of television history. They were some of the original films shot on location, over 6 hours worth. Not only were they in extremely good condition, but they were actually in colour.
Colour floods a series of black and white images. A sailboat, a chameleon, a young David stepping out of a plane, and a tribesman.
They show animals filmed for the first time, as well as being a unique cultural record of a bygone era.
A loincloth'd child watching a seaplane approach, a Komodo dragon with its forked tongue flicking in and out, David on horseback.
I was astonished to hear that they had all this colour negative stock. I had never seen it. Indeed, nobody had ever seen it, I think. It had never been printed in colour.
A praying mantis pouncing on an insect.
And it had an extraordinary quality, quite unlike modern colour film, and certainly unlike modern colour television.
And now the best of this original colour footage can be seen for the first time. And with it, the story of how this pioneering television series was made.
BBC, ZooQuest in colour. A 4x4 pulling a trailer drives through shallow water, then up a sandy incline.
I was astonished when someone said, we've got nearly all the film of the first three expeditions you did in colour. I said, it's impossible, we shot in black and white.
I hadn't seen a foot of that film since it went out. And when it went out, it was all in black and white, and it looked pretty miserable.
Using the latest technology to remaster the original colour film, it can now be seen in high definition as never before.
A split screen shows dancers half in black and white and half in colour.
I was absolutely staggered at the quality. At its best, it's as good as any colour you see now. And the big close-ups of animals, the faces and the eyes. Quite staggering for the period that it was filmed in. I was astonished.
Charles Lakers, cameraman.
And there is a good reason as to why colour film was used. It was all due to David's choice of using a lightweight, handheld 16mm camera.
I was insistent that we would have to use 16mm film. But now, that was very much smaller than the 35mm, which the BBC used. Well, we couldn't take these very big cameras into the bush in Africa. And the head of films of the BBC thought that 16mm was beneath contempt. There was a bit of a row. So we had a big meeting, and eventually I got permission to use 16, but it was the first time ever for BBC television. But the film department had their own back. They said, all right, well, if you use 16, you will have to shoot it on colour negative, because that will give you much better definition. It won't be as fuzzy as black and white negative would do. I had to go and find somebody who would shoot this. And I heard that there was an amateur cameraman, a young chap, who was very good on 16mm cameras. So I discovered his name, which was Charles Lagus.
I met this young man called Attenborough, who nobody had ever heard of before, and we got chatting.
Well, I said, look, I'm going to West Africa. Would you be at all interested in coming? And he said, well, I might.
We seemed to hit it off straight away.
We laughed at the same jokes, and so at the end of it, I said, would you like to come along? He said,
well, am I actually doing the job with you? He said, well, yes, of course you are. David and I were really nobodies. Somebody who was going off with 16mm film, they were amateurs.
We were rebels, really, and rather sneered at, I think, by film department, certainly. I got to know a lovely man called Jack Lester, who was in charge of the reptile houses of the London Zoo. Jack was going to be the star. I was the director. And so Jack, Charles and I were the team. What we were going to do was to film sequences in Africa of Jack Lester collecting things. He would pounce on a snake, let us say, and then we would dissolve from that film sequence to the snake in the studio with Jack struggling with it and explaining it. And that was the idea. The zoo agreed and the BBC agreed and Jack and I both agreed. Off we went. Charles and I set off with Jack and a chap called Alf Woods, one of the senior keepers from the birdhouse. And when we landed in Sierra Leone, it was the first time I'd ever been to the tropics, and I was absolutely knocked out. I remember very clearly walking across the grass strip, and then I saw something moving. It was a chameleon. I thought, chameleon in the hedge here. And there was a mantis, and I was suddenly struck by the huge proliferation of life, which is characteristic of the tropics. And that muggy air, that tropical air, not only loaded with moisture, but loaded with smells from the earth and from the forest.
We set off in our lorry along the dusty red earth roads, which cut through the thick tropical bush, on our way to the interior. But distances in Sierra Leone are not only measured in miles, they're also measured in rivers and the slow, hand-pulled ferries that cross them. But to us, the time spent on ferries wasn't wasted. We hoped to take back to London a representative collection of the whole of the animal life of this part of Africa. And the ferrymen, being the biggest gossips in the area, were just the people to tell us if anyone had caught any animals recently, and to pass on the extraordinary news to all travelling along the road that a party of Englishmen were willing to buy animals of all sorts and were offering rewards to anyone who could show them the nests of some extraordinary bald-headed bird.
I wanted an objective for our trip. I said to Jack Lester, I said, couldn't we make it a quest for something? And he said, well, I suppose we could. And I said, well, isn't there something that nobody's ever seen before live?
Jack had a fascination for a bird called Picathartes gymnocephalus.
And I said, yeah, well, Jack, you see, I mean, a quest for Picathartes gymnocephalus is not a winning title.
It was a very boring-looking bald crow.
You know, hasn't he got another name? He said, oh, yeah. Oh, I said, great. What's the English name? He said, a bald-headed rock crow. And I said, well, even quest for a bald-headed rock crow is not, you know, a crowd pleaser particularly. Not when to drag him in. So and then we just called it Zoo Quest.
1954.
We came to our first African village, where life continues in the same way as it's done for hundreds of years.
In a village of thatched dwellings.
An old man sits patiently weaving his cloth in the ancient traditional way.
He threads yarn on a rudimentary weaving loom.
Women sit in the shade of the huts, carding and spinning the locally grown cotton ready for the weaver.
three topless tribeswomen pounding the contents of a tub with stout sticks.
Cassava and rice has to be pounded to flour in wooden pestles. But here, as everywhere else, there's time for beautification.
A young woman having her hair coiffed.
Outside the village, as outside every village, large or small, in West Africa, there was one tree supporting a great chattering colony of weaver birds.
Thanks to their convenient location, these weaver birds were in fact the first wild animals ever to be filmed for a David Attenborough series.
They're very destructive creatures, causing a great deal of damage to crops of grain, but although it would be easy enough to cut down the trees and destroy the nests, the villagers rarely take any action against the birds, for they believe that if you drive away the weaver birds, you will drive away prosperity from the village. And so the birds are left to strip the leaves from their tree, tear them into long ribbons, and sew and weave them into their beautiful, intricate nests. Our first duty on arriving in the village was to pay our respects to the chief. If he gave us his official approval, we could be sure of the help of the best hunters in the district. The chief came out of his compound to meet us, followed in procession by some of his many wives.
The chief's imposing figure is encased in flowing robes.
Everyone gathered round to see what we wanted, and we were the objects of a great deal of curiosity, not entirely unmixed with fear as far as the children were concerned.
A small boy peers inquisitively.
Jack explained that we had come to collect all sorts of animals, and as we didn't know the African names, we carried pictures of the creatures we particularly wanted. This, the emerald starling, the chief recognized, though he would insist on turning it upside down. But Picathartes, right way up or upside down, didn't mean anything at all to him. But did we like snakes, he said.
Jack was great with snakes. He would pick up the most poisonous snakes that local people were terrified of.
A gaboon viper, and just as deadly as the cobras. It was crawling only a few yards away from our hut. It looked sluggish, but it can strike like lightning.
And now its beautiful markings can be seen in their full glory. They provide perfect camouflage when amongst the leaf litter of the forest floor.
Our people had found it, and like most of us, they were terrified of it. But when Jack heard of it, he was delighted and came running, anxious to catch such a handsome snake for his reptile house in the zoo.
A local holds open the lid of a box while Jack wields a long pole and tries to loop the snake over the end of it.
A gaboon viper is a very formidable thing. Jack, in fact, catches it by either the back of the neck, or indeed, rather more dangerously, I think, picking it up by the tail and then making sure that it doesn't get anywhere near where it can bite you. And then dropping it in a box or a sack. Of course, 60 years ago, zoos regularly sent out expeditions to collect live animals. Nobody thought much about conservation or really considered that animals might be driven to extinction. Of course, these days, you would never dream of doing that.
People started bringing boxes and cages to us in great numbers. The contents of this box we wanted very much indeed, for sticking her fingers through the slats and scratching anyone who came near was a very young baby chimpanzee. Within 4 days, we'd so won her confidence that she had run to take milk from Jack's lap. And from then on, Jane, as we christened her, was the tamest and most affectionate animal in the collection.
And it was so rewarding because it almost became one of the family with us. It would put its arms round us and just hug us.
She spent most of her time climbing about in the trees nearest to whichever hut we happened to be staying in.
The chimp climbs high up into the branches of a large tree before finding some emerald green leaves to chomp on.
In those days, it was quite common for people to have baby chimpanzees as pets. Jane was quite young, actually, and I looked after her, and I became very fond of her, and she was a sweet creature.
And Jane became a firm favourite with viewers at home.
Again, something you would not possibly be allowed to do these days, and again, quite right.
Jane, the chimpanzee, was always curious as to see what was going on, and insisted on inspecting each new addition to the collection as it arrived, like this little antelope.
Jane climbs out of David's arms to sit beside the tiny antelope on the grass.
But this young mongoose didn't appreciate her attentions at all and gave her a sharp nip.
As we built up a collection, somebody would have to look after all these newly captured animals.
At our base, Alf Woods, who came out from the zoo's birdhouse, was looking after our rapidly growing collection. This small section contains our sunbirds. They live by sipping nectar from flowers, but in captivity they will feed and flourish on a mixture of honey and water, which they sip from these little jars. When a new one is first brought in, it has to be shown that the jars contain something worth eating. So Alf always held it in his hand, dipped its beak into the honey, and he drinks, his thread-like tongue flashing in and out at an enormous rate.
The way things got looked after, it was amazing. And I don't think we ever lost an animal.
In this tin, we had two little African bush rats, which were even younger. They were so small that they couldn't tackle solid foods, so we fed them with milk from a pen filler.
David feeding the tiny rodent with a dropper.
David and Jack, and in the early days Alfie Woods, knew exactly how to look after everything that we caught, and they were just amazing with them.
A great difficulty with all these youngsters is to keep them warm, and at first we always put little bottles of hot water inside their tins overnight. This young ground squirrel, though very weak when he first arrived, did well under this treatment and ate vast quantities of palm nuts.
David strokes the squirrel's head before offering it a palm nut to nibble.
Young birds always had to be fed by hand. This young owl demanded food every 3 hours.
From a fluffy white owl chick to rushing water in semi-darkness.
But when the team went out to film animals in the wild, there was a problem.
In West Africa, in the forest, it's really very dark. And I remember Charles going in the first time he went in, and he said, we can't film here at all. I said, what do you mean not at all? And that was a bit of a blow. And he said, well, there is not enough light. I said, even for black and white, negative, not... He said, no, it's just too dark. The only way we can film here to get a decent picture is to cut down a tree. And so that was a bit of a facer, really. But when I did realise, therefore, we'd have to think of something else. And so what we decided to do was that we would film birds that were out in the open, or we would go into clearings in the forest. Now, there aren't big animals sitting in the clearings, but there are small animals.
We were interested in little animals as well as big ones, and one of the commonest insects in Africa is the termite. There's more than one sort of individual termite. The most common are the small workers, but among them are the soldiers, with enormously enlarged heads, armed with great jaws, with which they can give a most painful bite. Naturally, when the nest is disturbed, the soldiers are very much on the warpath, and so cutting a section of their nest can become quite a painful business.
Close-up photography of things like insects was almost unknown. Nobody had done this before.
Charles was really very inventive. He took an ordinary hollow piece of metal and screwed it on the end of a lens, and so increased the magnification, as it were. And he was very, very ingenious at doing that.
When you get a close-up of a praying mantis, they are fascinating in themselves. It's like magic.
A praying mantis grooming itself, and a face-off between two insects.
They were very impressive shots. We noticed that there was a wasp on the veranda, and before I could make it out, Charles was up there and filming it. There was a male wasp hanging on the side of the nest, waiting to grab the female before some other male grabbed her and fertilised her.
Once more, another male arrives.
A wasp squeezes its head out through a small hole in the nest.
Things are now getting tense. The young female continues her struggles and hauls herself to the mouth of the cell. And now she's free. He seizes her and flies off.
It wasn't what I thought we had come to film, if you see what I mean. But we made a speciality. That's what we could do, and so we did it.
An orange millipede rolls itself into a ball.
But the team still hadn't found the subject of their quest, the elusive Picathartes.
After an hour of cutting a path through the bush up the hill, we at last began to get good views of the surrounding countryside. No one in the first village we stayed in had recognised our picture of Picathartes, and we decided to move on through the bush towards the interior.
A steep incline, thick with foliage.
At last, we reached the next village.
Very often when we would come to a village, it was quite a ceremonial event for the people.
A man blows a large horn, its shaft intricately carved with bands of ridges and circles.
And they would welcome us, they would play music, and usually quite sophisticated, complicated music to our ears.
I don't think they'd seen film cameras there before, and they certainly had never heard themselves recorded. There was no way of linking sound recording to film in those days, on 16mm at any rate.
And David used to do the sound. Not that he'd been any way trained. It was quarter-inch tape, reel-to-reel, battery-driven. David took to it like duck to water. By being very careful in the editing later, it isn't all that noticeable that we haven't got sync sound.
A portable tape machine was quite a new thing. No one had seen it in most of the parts of Sierra Leone where we were, so they'd no idea what we were doing.
First to perform for us were the newly initiated girls who had just passed through the rites of the Bundu secret society.
They dance exuberantly, dressed in grass skirts adorned with strips of colourful fabric. A hooded figure in black.
And here, joining the girls in the dance, is the Bundu devil, who presides over the initiation ceremonies in the sacred bush.
The person inside the devil's costume swings back and forth, emphasising the long fur-like black coat. Young women shaking wooden balls in string nets, then two men beating drums that resemble giant peanuts.
A change of music. These drums, we knew, were used in the dance of the Njai Society, which we had been told we were not allowed to see.
One of the drums is decorated with broad white vertical stripes.
As they sounded, the Njai devil itself came into the dance, a very fearsome, magical devil that has the gift of foretelling the future.
Like the Bundu devil's costume, the body comprises of a voluminous fur-like coat. A black face mask, decorated with white markings, is topped with a headdress fan of black feathers. The women shake their percussion balls to the rhythm of the drums, while one performs a barefooted shuffle dance on the sandy ground.
But we were able to produce some magic of our own, for while the dance had been going on, I had been recording the music on my tape recorder. This, of course, was the object of a great deal of curiosity, and I always played the recording back and let the singers listen to themselves on a little earphone. Blank astonishment was always followed by huge grins of delight.
We tried to explain what we were doing, but they couldn't understand it. What we could do was to turn a switch and then use the microphone, which was a big handy thing, a big thing like that, use that as a speaker. And so we recorded something with the women, and then I played it to them through the ear. And they started off by being sort of astounded, and then suddenly delighted. They thought it's absolutely thrilling, you know.
Each tribeswoman beams as David holds the microphone to their ear.
Meanwhile, Jack was talking to other members of the village and showing our picture of Picathartes to everybody he met. Puhindi was the local agricultural instructor living in the village, and to our delight, he at last recognized the picture. The birds, he said, were not common, but he had seen them in the thicker part of the bush, up in the hills, at the back of the village. So it was that the next day, under Puhindi's guidance, we started off on the journey up the hill, on our way at last to the nests of Picathartes.
The problem with the Picathartes nesting site was that it was in deep jungle, and it was very, very dark, and there was simply not enough light for the colour negative stock that we were using, so we had to use black and white.
David looking through binoculars.
We took our places behind the hide, and now came the most tense moment of the expedition, the moment for which we'd all waited so long. Would we see the adult birds?
It was a six-part series. We ended each programme by saying, but will we find Picathartes gymnocephalus, you see? Tune in next week. And I was a bit worried about whether this would actually make any impression on anybody. And actually, Charles Legas and I were in Charles's open red... He had an open two-seater sports car, and we were driving along Oxford Street, which you could do in those days. And the driver leant out and he said, "Hello, Dave. Well, are we or are we not going to catch Picca bloody farties?" So I thought, well, maybe the programmes are beginning to catch on.
Suddenly, we saw one, a few yards away in the twilight of the bush, preening itself. This was enormous excitement. Then up it fluttered onto the nest, and as it did so, the other parent flew across and drove the first one away. This was a great thrill for us, for as this happened, we became the first Europeans ever to see the white-necked Picathartes on its nest.
It did take us several weeks before we actually found it. In a childish way, you know, to film something that nobody had ever filmed alive before tickled our fancy. We thought it was fun.
And eventually we secured a young fledgling. Alf Woods offered it a little frog. To our delight and relief, it accepted it greedily and asked for more.
Feeding it alone was a chore. It ate something like 60 little froglets every 3 hours. So not only were we filming, but we were spending our time catching frogs.
And on that food, it grew and flourished and made the long voyage back to England. Now it's settled and thriving in the London Zoo, the first white-necked Picathartes ever to be brought out of Africa alive.
The first ZooQuest programme went out with Jack Lester showing the animals and I up in the gallery directing the television cameras, which was what my job was. But after that first appearance, Jack became very ill with a tropical disease. He was taken to hospital just after the first programme. And so the head of television said, "Attenborough, you thought you were a director, but somebody's got to do the studio. Nobody else was there. You do it."
And it turned out that he was absolutely brilliant at it. In fact, he was much better at it than Jack. He was just a natural.
That is the picture of a very rare bird, the white-necked Picathartes.
And he could, particularly in the earlier ones, he would laugh at himself because he knew he was sort of acting for the camera.
One of those Indians taught me how to make the noise. At least I think I can do it. He goes, "Wada!" Is that any good, do you think?
Ask him.
And that's how he became the narrator and became one of the great natural television broadcasters.
And here he is, the very same one, the tree anteater or tamandua. That's right, isn't it?
Well, tamandua, we call it, but...
Very well.
All television was live, and if you didn't get it right first time, that was just tough. Everybody saw you making a mistake.
And for the last time, from Dr. Matthews, Jack Lester, Charles Lagos, and myself, good night.
The Zoo Quest was a success. I thought, right, well then, in that case, strike while the iron's hot, and I immediately suggested that we should go to somewhere in South America. And the obvious place to go was British Guiana, as it then was, and it is now Guyana. And Jack had recovered, and so we set off on our second trip.
This was in 1955, soon after the first series was broadcast.
There were still areas there where it was pristine, really, relatively speaking.
That is the South American jungle as I first saw it. And we were flying over British Guiana. That forest below us stretched unbroken for several hundred miles up north to the River Orinoco, and right down south to the Amazon and the Mato Grosso. In fact, it's one of the largest unexplored and, as far as I'm concerned, exciting areas in the world.
A seaplane landing on a river.
There were three of us in that plane, Jack Lester from the London Zoo, Charles Lagos, the cameraman, and myself.
A boy in a red loincloth watches it taxi on the water.
As we came in, we saw for the first time some of the Akawayo Indians with whom we would be living for the next month, though these particular people were partly Europeanized as they lived and worked on the government station. Our first job was to unload all our stores from the plane. Lenses, cameras, film, recording gear, cooking pots and pans, food, hammocks, and all the other things we needed to make us entirely self-sufficient. For when the plane left, we should lose our last link with the outside world. If we'd forgotten to bring something, well, from now on we should have to do without it. Our plan was to travel up the Mazaruni River and explore its tributaries. And for transport, the district officer very kindly lent us his largest dugout canoe. And we set off up the river, a tunnel of sunshine cutting through the jungle. For us, it was all very exciting, because at last we were seeing the South American jungle close at hand. We couldn't expect to see any animals, for the noise of our engine would have driven them far away. But we were happy enough simply to sit there and enjoy the ride. Late in the afternoon, we heard a distant thundering noise, and we knew that we were approaching a waterfall. After another hour, we reached it. To go further would mean unloading all the canoes and carrying everything above the fall. So we decided to camp that night on the banks. And while the boys unloaded the canoe, Jack Lester and I enjoyed ourselves.
Swimming beside the waterfall.
Filming in Guyana had its problems. For me, humidity and rain was the big challenge on equipment. How was I going to store all this stuff without getting it wet, without having mildew and fungus growing on everything? It was a challenge.
So we had biscuit tins with silica gel, which was or absorbs moisture. So every time we shot something, we put it in the biscuit tin, and then when the tin was full, we sealed it with camera tape, and there it was with silica gel.
You've only got to get a scratch on a film, something wrong with the exposures, a hair in the gate, and you've wrecked everything. we could be away for 3 or 4 months thinking that we got a film, and the rushes come back ruined. And this really was a nerve-wracking thing to live with.
Despite the tricky conditions, the team soldiered on.
The first village we entered seemed deserted. Then we noticed 2 tame parrots on the eaves of one of the huts. Whatever else these people were, they were obviously pet keepers, and of course nothing could have been better from our point of view. Soon the women emerged from the huts and looked at us silently and impassively. But there were no men, for, as we later discovered, they were all out in the forest on a hunting expedition. In their absence, the women were busy with the household chores. This young girl is weaving a bead apron, or motza, which traditionally is the only clothing that the women wear. 2 other girls were busy cutting cassava. Cassava is the plant from whose swollen, starchy roots the Indians make their bread. As a food, though, it seems to me to have serious limitations, because its juice contains a deadly poison, prussic acid, in fact, so that before you eat it, you must prepare it very carefully to get rid of the poison. First it is peeled, and then the peeled roots are grated on a board studded with small pieces of sharp stone.
Bent over, a girl grates a root in each hand on a board, which is set at a 45-degree angle, with its top edge resting against her thighs.
But you've still not got rid of the poisonous juice. And to extract that, the Indians employ an extendable squeezer that is a most cunning piece of basket work. As you fill it, the weight of the grated cassava makes it become short and fat.
A woman stuffs the cylindrical basket with more cassava.
When it's quite full, it's carried and hung on the end of one of the rafters of a hut. A pole is stuck through the loop at the bottom.
Applying downward pressure on the pole makes it act like a lever and stretches the basket.
And then all you have to do is to sit on it. Your weight makes the squeezer stretch so that instead of being short and fat, it becomes long and thin. And the juice, with its prussic acid, pours out at the bottom. Sometimes the Indians collect this juice and use it in making poison for their blowpipe darts. When the cassava is squeezed and the Indians are satisfied that there's no more poisonous juice in it, it is emptied in dry, pulpy lumps into a wicker basket. Then it's broken up and sifted into a sort of coarse flour. The actual cooking of the bread was to me fascinating, because it's done in exactly the same way as griddle cakes and oat cakes are made in Scotland and Wales. It's cooked, in fact, on a circular bake stone heated over a fire. But as in Wales and Scotland, so in the Upper Mazaruni River, housewives have a little bad luck in turning the cakes. When the flat white circle of cassava bread is cooked on both sides, it's put out on racks to dry in the sun. Having seen the whole of the cooking process, I thought I really ought to see what the bread tasted like. Courtesy made me pretend that I enjoyed it, but I can't say I'd like to spend the rest of my life living on cassava bread as the Indians do.
As the Zoo Quest series continued, it revealed as much about the local people as the animals.
The children of the village had much better things to do than to cook. Fishing is much more fun. These 2 lads, Carlton and Codris, became great friends of ours.
Codris
course, they knew the jungle absolutely backwards. And they took us into the rainforest and made us feel ashamed at how little we knew and how much they knew.
There were two other pets in the village, and rather odd ones. Capybara. They're not related to pigs, as you might think, but belong to the family that includes rats and mice, the rodent family. They are, in fact, the largest rodents in the world, and when fully grown, they can be 3 feet long. These two were comparatively young ones. They had been reared from tiny babies by the grandmother of our two friends, Carlton and Cordris. They had never quite forgotten their childish habit of suckling and were prepared to suck anything that was offered them, including my finger.
A square-headed, reddish-brown capybara sucks hungrily on David's index finger.
Nevertheless, they were fully equipped with the long front incisor teeth of the rodent family. And they ate bushels and bushels of grass.
They were very much village pets, actually. And although people ate capybaras, in order that nobody else would kill these village pets, which had been reared since they were very young, they put red patches of paint on them so that they were identifiable.
The oddest thing about them is that they are really amphibious animals, and in the wild, they spend a great deal of their time swimming in the rivers. There are two clues to this habit of theirs. The first is that their eyes and nostrils are placed very high on their head, so that, like the crocodile and the hippopotamus, they can lie submerged in the river with just their eyes and nostrils out of water. And the second is that their feet are webbed. We were very anxious to film them swimming, and for a long time I tried to persuade them to go down into the river, but they wouldn't.
And Jack's big thing was, these are supposed to be aquatic animals. Why don't they ever go in the water? I want to see film of them in the water.
And so I wanted to show this, but the wretched things wouldn't go into the river.
And then early one morning, Carlton and Cordris ran down to the river for a swim.
They just jumped into the river, and of course these capybara, which were semi-tame, followed them and jumped in the river too.
And we got lovely film of the boys playing with the capybaras in the river.
And we discovered that not only were the two boys and their grandmother's capybara habitual playmates, but that the pets would in fact never go into the water without the boys.
A capybara takes tentative steps into the orangey-brown water to join the boys.
I certainly wouldn't like to have said which of them were the better swimmers.
While the boys splash around in the river, the two capybaras stay close to the bank, nuzzling each other playfully.
And it wasn't only Carlton and Cordris who enjoyed swimming in the river.
One of the boys dives over David's head into the water. David, who's been leaning on the side of a canoe, takes a few confident strokes out into the river. Then the boys swim up to the canoe and hold on to the side.
After their swim, there was another skill the boys wanted to show off.
And our two friends, Carlton and Cordris, gave us a short exhibition of blowpipe practice, using a small pineapple as a target.
Their blowpipes are about 2 metres in length. A dart flies just over the pineapple, while another becomes embedded in the wooden stump it's sitting on. The boys laugh as they reload, then a third dart hits its target.
Both the little boys loaded these blowpipes. And you look along the top, and they went, and sometimes they missed, but mostly they were pretty accurate.
Another dart misses by a few centimetres.
After spending several weeks in the Mazaruni Basin, the team continued their search throughout Guyana for animals that had never been filmed before.
A shaggy-haired mammal eating leaves, a three-toed sloth looking all around it, an anteater climbing down a slender tree trunk. Various insects merging into their environment, a caterpillar with a green fern-like body, and another furry brown specimen crawling along a twig. A praying mantis with a flat back that resembles a succulent leaf, and a butterfly with speckled leaves for wings. A large gathering of wading birds.
Besides egrets, there were also other birds, blue herons. And here, on the top of a tree, a snail-eating hawk, living up to its name by actually eating a snail as we watched.
One of the most interesting, as far as I was concerned, was a bird called a hoatzin, which lived in the coastal swamps. It had claws on the front of its wings. And birds, as a whole, are thought to have been derived from four-legged creatures, perhaps branch of the dinosaur group. So, in a way, that gave you an insight into what the early birds with claws on their front legs, their wings, were like as they clamped around in the trees. It was the first film of hoatzin ever taken, as far as I know.
Two of the large birds take flight.
The next destination for David and the team was the savannah of South Guyana. But the journey was not entirely plain sailing.
Some of the transport, when we were lucky, was a little seaplane driven by a wonderful pilot. He must have been ex-Air Force or something like that, because he was just brilliant. And we had to take off on a fairly shortish stretch of river, which finished in very tall, jungly trees. In it, we had Jack Lester, me, David, and a mass of equipment. It looked awfully overloaded to me. And Colonel Art Williams said, "Don't worry, lads," he said, "I've done this before." And the engine started. He put absolutely full boost on. And we roared down this stretch of river, and we got faster and faster.
One of the seaplanes floats, skimming the water.
And suddenly, I could see the trees coming closer and closer and closer, but he was going straight, and I was sure, convinced we were going to go straight into them, when suddenly, when they were just very, very close to, he suddenly put his arm round the controls and leant back like the seaplane, but up into the sky. And while he was doing that, he suddenly started fumbling. I said, "Are you okay?" "Yeah," I said, "I need my bifocals." But he changed his glasses, and we just made it.
Plane flying at treetop height, then passing over a cargo ship on a stretch of wide, murky brown river. Cultivated fields bordering jungle from the air, then a map of British Guyana.
After what was certainly an interesting flight, they finally arrived at their destination, the wide savannah in the southwest, the Rupununi. Here they met up with ranch owner Teddy Melville.
He took us up to a remote part of his ranch, where he said he had heard reports of a large anaconda snake.
The ZooQuest team climb out of a 4x4.
The savannas were littered with giant termite hills standing like tombstones. Teddy took us down to a thicket in a swamp where the snake was supposed to lurk. But instead of finding signs of an anaconda, Teddy's sharp eye immediately picked out the footprints of a giant anteater.
The big thing was whether we could get a giant anteater, so we had a go at it in a rather extraordinary way, amateur, ham-fisted way.
While we were looking at them, there was a rustle on the other side of the thicket. We looked up, and there was the anteater itself, galloping across the savannas. Without thinking how we were actually going to catch it, Jack and I set off wildly in pursuit.
Shaky footage of the pursuit.
And I ran after it. What I was going to do, I can't imagine. But I actually tried to slow it down by catching its tail. But when it turned around and had a look at me, I decided that was as far as I was going to take this.
David's colleague, Jack, joins in the chase.
Giant anteaters have these huge, powerful paw legs with enormous great claws on them, which they rip open termite hills. And the one thing to avoid was the embrace of the giant anteater because it was lethal.
Catching up with it, David runs alongside, waving his arms, but the creature continues to run on.
The local rancher who was helping us lassoed it. Poor old thing. And we captured it. Jack had got it for the zoo. And it did very well. It lived for quite a long time.
With all the animals collected, the expedition in South America had come to an end. But sadly, Jack Lester took a turn for the worse.
Jack suddenly collapsed again, and he had to be flown home urgently. And the expedition then came to an end.
It turned out that they didn't know what it was.
I'm very sorry to say that Jack has been very ill, started halfway through the expedition, and he's still in hospital. I think he's probably looking in, and we all wish him a very speedy recovery.
When we came back, he was in hospital. So there was no question of him taking part. And in fact, he never really recovered, and he died a few months later.
A photo of Jack showing a frog to some schoolchildren.
The Guyana series was another big hit with the British public. Keen to keep ZooQuest as a regular event, it was time for David to choose the next destination.
ZooQuest for a Dragon, 1956.
We'd done Africa, we'd done South America, and the Far East would be the obvious place. And I had read about giant lizards, which were the press had called dragons, which lived on a very small island in the middle of the Indonesian archipelago, in a place called Komodo.
Well, having found it on the map, we then had to try and get there. But nobody in London could give us any idea as to how we could do so. So Charles and I decided the thing to do would be to fly to Singapore and then somehow, in some way or another, make our way slowly southwards and eastwards through these islands to Komodo. And the first place we decided to go to was the mouth of the Mahakam River, which goes right into the heart of Borneo.
A riverboat.
Everyone had told us that the river was infested with man-eating crocodiles, but it wasn't until one morning, 3 weeks after our arrival in Borneo, when I was looking for frogs that were whistling and chirping in the swamps fringing the riverbank, that I actually saw one.
Its long reptilian body lying in shallow water.
And it was no ordinary one either, but the variety with the long, thin nose, the gavial.
The only problem with it was tiny. I mean, it was a baby. So I had the idea that we would make a kind of joke of it and that we'd film it all in close-up. And then I'd film myself taking off my shirt and we hoped the audience would say, he's not going to tackle that huge thing.
The footage of David removing his shirt.
And they would only, until when I jumped on it, would the people realise how that it was just a tiny thing.
David catching it in his shirt.
As you can see, no one could class this little baby as a man-eater, even though he had got quite a bite.
We shot it that way and edited that way, but as far as I can see, nobody ever saw the joke.
With its jaws clamped on his shirt, David carries the tiny croc out of the shallows and onto the riverbank.
Happily, we had met a very nice English-speaking Dutchman called Dan Hubrecht, who acted as an interpreter for us.
The village itself, like all Dyke villages, consisted only of a single long house, which stretched for several hundred yards along the riverbank. The people who watched us from the galleries of the house seemed to be very different from those we had met lower down the river. The headman was on his way into the forest to hunt. He showed us his stout blowpipe tipped with a spearhead, which he said was very useful for stabbing. And his hat, which was very light and woven from palm leaves. We both bought and wore ones like it later on and found them to be ideal headwear for the tropics, cool and shady. He never carried a gun, he told us, but relied on his parang, the crude and heavy Dayak bush knife. He said that we would be very welcome to stay in the village for as long as we wished.
The longhouse never went to sleep. I mean, there's always somebody trundling about, so all the time you were going up and down like this. And down on the ground, there were pigs and there were chickens, and they were moving around all night. And on top of that, there were some people chanting. And I don't think I slept at all the first night. And in the morning, I said, what's all the chanting about? And they said they were chanting because some important people have recently died. It's a funeral chant. I said, really? Oh, yeah. Where are the bodies? He said, didn't you notice them? They were just alongside you there. Oh, I thought, didn't realise. But no, it was a communal life, all right. And they were lovely people. And one of them found a little baby bear, a cub.
The little cub was obviously very young. I reckoned about 2 weeks old. He seemed to be in good condition, but he hadn't got any teeth and obviously was still feeding on milk. We had got a baby's bottle on board, ready for such a case as this, but I wondered whether he was yet old enough for us to be able to rear him. First, however, he had to be put in a box and covered up so that he kept warm. As soon as the sun went down, it gets quite cold on that river, and we didn't want to risk our new pet catching a chill. And then I had to set about the urgent job of making a bottle of dilute condensed milk. Urgent because the little cub was already calling very loudly indeed for his food. The milk seemed to be about the right temperature.
David feeding the cub from a baby's bottle.
And to my relief, the young cub was soon guzzling away contentedly.
The cub sucking on the bottle's rubber teat. Then, in a studio.
And here he is. Twice as large, I should say, but still just as hungry, and still making this extraordinary little noise which he used to make out there in Borneo. Oh, Benjamin. He's grown considerably since we had him. The cameraman who took all those pictures is here. And Charles has had him in his flat ever since we came back. And has he caused any trouble, Charles?
Well, he's fairly destructive. He likes eat lino and newspapers, telephone directories, almost everything.
Benjamin became known as the ZooQuest mayor, and I even wrote a little book about him. He was charming.
Very nice. Well, you're very sweet. What about his teeth? Have you had a bite from him?
Yes, he draws blood regularly now when he misses the bottle and gets your finger instead.
Well, in that case, I think we'll let him go. When you've finished, Benjamin, we'll let him go back to your flat and draw a little more blood.
Benjamin had very bent little feet, and I took it for a walk on a little collar, and a woman appeared from the distance, shaking her umbrella at me. He said, "Can't you see your dog's got rickets?" And then she looked at it and said, "Oh, it's a bear," and she ran off in the opposite direction.
Locals watching a departing 4x4.
After Borneo, David and Charles travelled eastwards across Java, the next island on their quest.
The 4x4 crosses a shallow river, then drives up a rough, winding track towards tall trees.
On our way through Java, we passed many beautiful buildings, but we saw none more lovely than the beautiful Buddhist temple of Borobudur, which was built over 1,000 years ago. It rises tier upon tier shrine upon shrine, until at the top there is one final gigantic monument.
A huge dome topped with a stubby spire.
But Java is a country not only of temples, but of volcanoes, and our route eastwards took us past the still active crater of Bromo. The jeep couldn't take us up the mountain, so in the early dawn one morning, we met some hillmen and hired some ponies.
The ponies negotiating the dark volcanic terrain.
By midday, the volcano collects a blanket of cloud above it. But now, at 5 o'clock in the morning, it was still quite clear. To get to the crater, we had to descend onto a great plain, a sea of sand, which surrounds the central cone.
The cone's belching a huge column of grey smoke. David and his two companions approach it on their horses, then dismount.
Now the ground steepened, and we had to leave the horses and continue on foot.
With the others following behind, holding their guide's hands, David leads the way up the side of the volcano to reach the edge of the crater.
Looking down into the depths of the crater, it seemed easy enough to clamber right down to that central vent. But our guides would go no further, for they said that the crater was full of invisible pockets of poison gas, and that people who had gone farther down had never returned. Even from where we were standing, the air was full of choking, sulfurous fumes, and the ground beneath our feet shook as the clouds of poisonous smoke belched out from the vent. It's down there that sacrifices are thrown every year to placate the god of the volcano. These days, only chickens, cloth, and money. But in olden times, the sacrifice was a human one.
Smoke spews from the vent, adding to the billowing column rising up out of the crater.
We left the volcano with the clouds gathering in a shroud above it and continued on our way. And the next day, we reached the southern coast of Java and the sea, the Indian Ocean.
The team's 4x4 driving down a track to reach an empty stretch of beach where waves are crashing ashore. David and Charles walking along the shoreline.
Very often we slept on the beaches, which are wonderful places. It was very lucky that Charles and I got on so well together. I certainly look on back with my friendship with him and with great pleasure.
I don't know why we hit it off. We hit it off from day one. I don't think we ever had a crossword. I don't think we ever worried about each other's problems. I knew he could cope with what he was doing, and he relied, hopefully, on everything I was doing.
The next day, they set off inland.
A large snake in a tree.
In Jack Lester's absence, David had to take on the role of catching animals, including snakes.
It looked enormous, and from its size and markings, I was quite sure that it was a python, and therefore non-poisonous, which was something of a relief.
So I thought, oh, well, this is the moment. Nothing frightened, I skipped up the tree and took out my trusty cutlass, and I thought, I won't grapple with the snake up in the tree. I'll cut the branch down.
David climbing the tree with an assured, agile confidence. Perching in its branches, he begins hacking at the branch the python occupies with a bush knife. The python's mottled tail slithering further up a branch.
And the branch came down and I nipped down the tree and then was I had to face the python. So I tried to remember what I'd learned in West Africa, and I've picked up a sack and tried to throw it over an animal's head. Very inexpertly, I must say, nowhere near head, but I was quite nervous after all.
The snake's unfazed by David's attempts to catch it.
But eventually I managed to throw it over the animal's head and grasp it by the neck.
It's important to grab his tail as soon as you grab his head, otherwise he'll wrap his great coils round you and give you a very nasty squeeze. And here he is in the studio. The python is not a poisonous snake at all. It kills its prey by squeezing it.
Of course, my expertise as an animal handler, a zoo man, as it were, was exposed rather painfully every now and again on television.
Well, helping me control this python is Mr. Van Warn from the Reptile House in the London Zoo.
I'm pretending to be very accomplished and expertise by aspects in front of Mr. Landworn, who was the head keeper of the reptile house.
Well, he's quite a handful now, isn't he? You can quite imagine how these powerful coils give you quite a crush.
He was very charitable towards my attempts at trying to control this wretched snake.
He's doing it.
Well, there's a very good example of how he constricts his food.
Shall I just show you, or will you lose your hand?
No, I don't think so. I'll be able to get out eventually.
Well,
yeah,
I think we'll untie you later.
Right.
Thank you very much for coming.
A sail is raised on a wooden outrigger boat. David climbs out of the 4x4 on a ferry.
After leaving Java, the team continued their journey east onto Bali.
Sailing craft on a stretch of sun-dappled water, then the 4x4 driving off the ferry onto a beach.
A few minutes of travel was enough to show us that in coming to the island of Bali, we had come to a different world. There were high mud walls round the houses, which we'd never seen in Java. The people looked quite different. And as we travelled along the grassy tracks, we passed through the terraced rice fields for which Bali is famous.
A Balinese boy playing a flute. A farmer wearing a hat in the shape of a large, shallow, upturned bowl leads an ox through a paddy field. David walks along a grassy embankment lined with tall palm trees.
It was an intoxicating place because it was full of beauty.
A lush landscape of palms and terraced rice fields.
But above all, we were impressed by the great number of temples. There were temples everywhere, and all were decorated with a wealth of intricate carvings. This one lay in the centre of a small forest. Many Balinese temples are sacred to a particular animal, and the courtyard of this one was haunted by a troop of monkeys, ever hungry to snatch food from worshippers who came to the temple. It was a real joy to meet these bold creatures, even if they did do their best to steal things from my pocket.
A baby monkey munching a sprig of foliage, then a monkey grooming another's fur.
When they are grooming one another, they're not simply looking for fleas, but are searching one another's skin for tasty little grains of salt.
A parent keeping its youngster close.
We had a problem. When we changed film quickly on the camera, normally you'd have a clapperboard. Now, we didn't have clapperboards, we weren't running sync. So David invented a clever system, raffle tickets. He would always have them in his pocket. And when we changed a reel, he'd fish it out, and he'd just hold it up in front of the camera and stick it on the can of film And that was our way of pre-editing the film and knowing what was on what.
The whole business of 60mm film at the time, we didn't have any code of behaviour or any expertise, really. We just did it the way we thought was sensible.
It was clockwork driven, and you had 40 seconds of film before it ran out.
Then you had to stop and wind it up again. And it only took 100-foot reels, and that's 2 minutes 40 in 60mm.
So this is quite a handicap when you're filming.
Especially when filming complex sequences, like a village festival.
Balinese musicians sitting cross-legged in a row, playing cymbals on a carved frame.
The music of Bali is particularly beautiful, with gamelan music, and of the most brilliant kind. The gamelan plays and rehearses every night in the village.
These young girls are only 8 years old, and they've been training to perform this beautiful temple dance, the legong, since they were six. They wear on their heads crowns of leather and gold leaf, decorated with the ivory-coloured blossoms of the frangipani tree.
The girls perform the dance with intricately choreographed movements, manipulating their bodies with graceful, expressive gestures. Musicians playing drums and cymbals accompany the dance. Wafting delicate fans, the girls lean their bodies right back, then slowly lower into a crouching position.
While Charles filmed it, I recorded the music, and I think Bali's gamelan music was heard for the first time by millions of people in Britain. The Balinese are not only great sculptors and instrumental musicians, but they're also great actors, and they continue reenacting the stories from the Ramayana and from the Balinese version of some of the Hindu legends.
Now begins the masked play. A demon descends the temple steps.
The demon's mask has large bulging eyes, flared nostrils, and a mouth set in a broad smile of tombstone teeth. The barefooted dancer in the demon costume hops nimbly on the spot, hands extended and fingers splayed.
It's a deeply religious thing, and the villagers watch this enactment of this story again and again and again. One of the great epics is there's a battle between the evil, which is represented by a horrifying witch who has a long tongue and huge long fingernails and is a terrifying figure.
Ranga, the dreaded evil witch.
The demon and the witch square up to each other.
Who then attacks a very friendly mythical creature called a barong.
And now comes the superb barong, the mythical monster which lives in the temple and is the guardian of the village and of its graveyard.
And the battle between Ranga and the barong is one of the great dramas that is enacted by these rituals which go on every day.
And now begins the fight. The men from the village, in a state of trance, rush down from the temple, waving their swords to attack Ranga and protect the barong. But Ranga, by her evil power, is able to hold them at bay.
In a crouching stance, the villagers shrink from Rangda's domineering presence.
And then suddenly the Rangda makes a spell.
With a flourish of her magic cloth, she forces them to turn their daggers upon themselves. The men, almost insensible, try to thrust these sharp swords into their chests.
They really looked that they were going to pierce their abdomens with them. And they pushed and they pushed and they pushed.
But the Barong is sufficiently powerful, so it means that the daggers don't pierce their chests.
The Barong's power is stronger than Rangda's, and he is able to protect his followers so that no blood is shed.
The men writhing with the point of their dagger pressed against their chest.
Now the priest comes from the temple and scatters holy water to bring the men out of their trances.
The white-robed priest walks amongst the twisting and jerking dancers.
The men rush back into the temple. The Barong disappears, and all that is left are the mangy curs eating the priest's offerings to the gods. I can offer no explanation for that extraordinary performance, but I was a little worried lest Rangda the Witch should decide to turn their swords on the BBC. Well, 2 days after that dance, we had to leave Bali and continue on the last leg of our trip to Komodo, the island of the giant lizards, the dragons.
Komodo was on the western end, the farther end of this banana-shaped island. So we went down to the harbour.
There was one single sail, 30-foot little fishing boat there, and that was all there was. So eventually we managed to talk to the skipper of this boat, and he said, no problem. And we said, can you take us to Komodo? He said, oh, yes.
So we agreed, and there was Charles and me, and there was Sabran, our guide, who was the interpreter. And there was the captain and some boys who were his crew.
We had no choice by then, so we loaded all our stores onto this miserable little 30-footer.
We loaded all our equipment into the hold beneath the tiny cabin. That was the tape recorder. Our kit.
Being passed down from the jetty to the crew.
And the camera. We didn't take much food because we expected to be able to catch enough fish to last us for the few days it was going to take us to get to Komodo. Here comes Sabran.
Jumping down onto the deck.
The sail goes up. We haul up the anchor. And at last, we're off. We headed away from the shore, and soon the trade winds were filling our sails. The boys took it on in turn on the tiller. This is Hassan, a cheerful lad who, unfortunately, was not a particularly good steersman, as he had the habit of falling asleep at the tiller.
The boy would fall asleep day or night, and we'd finish up with his awful crunching noise in the night to find that we were on a coral island.
So I went back to the captain, I said, I think we're on a coral island. He said, ah, oh, stagamati, ah, they're no good. You see, so I said, what are we going to do? He said, so we eventually pulled ourselves off.
Sabran, always eager to make himself useful, had quickly improvised a kitchen in the stern. He had found an empty petrol tin, which would serve as a grate, and in it, he had lit a wood fire.
The trip took nearly 3 weeks. We lived entirely on boiled rice. The fish that we were going to have was non-existent. We said, where's your fishing tackle? Why aren't, this was early on. Why aren't you fishing? He said, I know fishermen.
To the south of us stretched the mountainous coast of Flores. Somewhere 200 miles ahead, lay Komodo. The wind was strong and fair, and we were making a good 4 knots through the brilliant clear blue sea.
And I then said to the captain, how long will it be before we get to Komodo? And the captain said, Tidatau, which means I don't know. The only map we had was the airline map, and Komodo was rather smaller than a full stop, a little dot on the western end.
And he looked at this map and he said, where are we?
That awful thought struck me, and I said, you have been to Komodo before, haven't you? And he said, Belum. And I didn't know what Belum meant, so I had to go down to the hold and cut out my little Indonesian dictionary and I'd take through it. And it said, Belum, not yet. So he'd no idea where we were going.
And we said to him, are you sure you know where you are? And he said, we are there. And he pointed to Borneo, which was probably about 1,000 miles away from us.
It was very hot in the blazing sun, and Hassan draped his sarong over his head to protect him from the heat. And we had nothing to do but to lie on deck and wonder what lay ahead of us in Komodo. Our fresh water was stored in this earthenware jar lashed to the tiny cabin. Unfortunately, it got very hot in the sun.
Could have been soup because it had nothing but mosquito larvae wriggling in it.
But nonetheless, it was quite refreshing.
This just went on and on and on, and we were hungry, sleeping out on deck, mosquitoes.
So it was in the evening, and it was blowing quite a gale, actually, and so I said to the captain, I think we go this way now, the sea.
But the sea rose, and it got darker, and it got darker, and it became quite dangerous.
And suddenly we were in whirlpools.
And the waves were tremendous. What were we going to do?
The water was going round, the ship was going round. You could see the sort of fangs of coral in rocks in the middle of this whirlpool. So we were there poling away and it's pouring with rain.
Quite honestly, neither of us were sure that we would ever see each other again.
Unfortunately, we weren't to show any of this on television because, of course, we weren't filming. Charles wasn't filming. Charles was poling away like the rest of us.
It was that dicey.
And the captain was saying things like, stigamati, stigamati. He's saying, I'm half dead, stigamati. And finally, about 4 o'clock in the morning, just before dawn, we managed to get out of the whirlpool area and into a calmer waters in a little bay.
So at last, we sailed safely into the wide, calm bay of Komodo. The island looked most exciting as we sailed close by its shores. Brilliant white beaches of coral sand, clumps of bush near the water's edge, and above them, gaunt, bare volcanic hills covered in sunburnt brown grass with a few palm trees here and there. This was the home of the dragon which we'd come so far to see.
David's rowed ashore in a canoe. Reaching the shallows, he jumps out and pulls the craft up onto the beach, which is lined with wooden huts on stilts.
We were so happy and relieved to have arrived after such a long and tricky voyage that to our eyes, the village seemed a real paradise. The Patingi, or headman, was sitting on the steps of his house. He welcomed us very kindly and invited us inside.
And the chief, the Patingi, gave us a little feast. And during that, he said, you know, that captain of yours is not a good man. He's actually a gun runner. He's been smuggling guns to rebels up in Sulawesi in Celebes, and the Navy's after him. And that's why he was the only person in the fishing in the harbour in Maumere. All the rest were out fishing.
With a lucky escape behind them, the team continued on their quest, this time with the added ingredient of dragon bait.
We walked, carrying the two goats with our cameras and recording equipment, ready for this final stage of our expedition.
The Komodo dragons had never been filmed, at least not professionally.
And this was going to be a top draw if we got pictures of one.
Wading across a river.
The only problem was there was not enough light. There was quite heavy bush there. It was too dark, according to Charles, for us to use our colour stock. So we had to film it in black and white.
Now we had to set about building a trap. All the materials you need to make it can be obtained in the forest itself.
They attached the trap door to a simple trigger mechanism using a rope.
He put a piece of goat's flesh inside and then shrouded that end with palm leaves. We waited, but not for long. Within half an hour, there was a rustle in the bush, and there was the dragon.
The huge lizard lumbering through the undergrowth.
This was tremendously exciting for us. Our first sight of this magnificent monster, the climax of 4 months of arduous travel. He was enormous. As he circled us, flicking out his great yellow tongue, he looked almost as though he had walked out of some prehistoric age.
This enormous monster, the size of a really big crocodile, appeared, sniffed the air, and eventually it went in after this dead goat.
Its tail disappears into the trap.
And down came the door. Hastily, we piled boulders on the door so that he couldn't lift it up. We'd got him.
But we didn't have a permit to take it away, so we had to content ourselves with just measuring it and looking at it in close detail. So we let this first famous dragon, let it go, and away it went into the bush. We had to use black and white negative stock for this climax of the whole trip. We thought we really ought to use the colour negative stock too if we could find dragons out in the open, as indeed we did, because on the island there are a lot of them. It was, I think, the first colour film taken of a Komodo dragon in the wild.
Like the series before it, Zoo Quest for a Dragon was another big hit.
The Zoo Quest expeditions did a lot for me. I never had to look for work again. And David became a very famous person, and it's Zoo Quest who made him that.
And Charles and David have remained lifelong friends.
They were good days, and I wouldn't change them. I think when you're 28, you do things rather differently from when you're 88. And you do silly things, which we undoubtedly did. Looking back, I don't think you would let two kids in their 20s just go off like that. And nobody asked us anything about health and safety or anything else. I mean, we just disappeared, and they said, when will you be back? Ooh, just before Christmas, I think. All right, oh, goodbye. So, happy days.
That was the end of our Zoo Quest. Good night.